nuts! And welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. Rob got it.
Did we all get? Yeah, I got it too.
You got? Okay, nice.
I think so. Can I guess?
I am. Yes, go for it.
Is it an Ardennes Forest reference?
It is indeed. I'm reading the Band of Brothers book right now, which I've probably seen that miniseries like, gosh, seven or eight times, but I've never actually read the book, and it's very good.
Is nuts what he wrote back to the German...
To the German commander who requested the surrender of...
During the Battle of the Bulge?
Yes, yeah. In the Ardennes Forest.
Fantastic reference.
I am Drew Scanlon, joining me, Danny O'Dwyer. How are you, Danny?
I'm doing good. I've turned a corner on Cargate, on a stolen Cargate. I've gone in a different... Well, no, the car has disappeared. I tried to do a license plate.
Okay, I'm glad that by turn the corner, you didn't mean you're like wandering the street like Charles Branson. Like, I need a really attractive car that I want people to try to steal from me so I can get some street justice. And I'd be like, Danny, I don't think that's the point of that movie. That's not
that's a
like,
good
that's
idea,
not like a
Rob.
Goals type thing.
You're right. I should. Did he get that idea from being on a podcast with his friends? Because I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, that didn't make the final cut of the film. But Charles Branson's character was part of like a lifestyle podcast. Yeah.
Nice. I was kind of reconsidering, like, should I get another Mustang and all this sort of stuff, especially because I purchased that car back when I had a commute and back before we entered the nightmare realm. So I was thinking, like, what other things could I do? And in the past week, I have basically convinced myself to become an overlander and get a Jeep Wrangler. So I have one sitting in front of my car, in front of my house right now, which I rented for 3 days. I'm going to try that Jeep life, get my Jeep Wave on and maybe do an overnight camping trip or something this week. So see what it's like. Yeah.
Speaking of World War II references, general purpose,
I know, right?
GP, what? General purpose. I think that's what Jeep stands for.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
GP is I've just come up, I've learned a lot about like roads I didn't know existed before, and also the term OHV, off-highway vehicle.
Oh.
Which is a term given to, I guess, you know, your scrambler bikes, your dune buggies, your Jeeps, I guess, on the high end. And that's where all those, like, you know, trails that go through, you know, forest and national parks and all that you can only take on these types of cars.
You
got a whole world out there.
Yeah, you should get one of those cars that the Icelandic dune buggies that have tires so big that they skip across the water if they drive fast enough.
Oh my god,
you ever seen those?
That sounds no are you sure it's
all
not
right.
ice
I gotta no it is they go so fast and their tires are so big that they get up to speed on land and then skim across the top of the water.
Yeah, do they look like hover tank big? Are we like comically big? Like
they're
monster
pretty,
truck
they're like,
big?
They're like tractor tires. They're big.
Okay. I've been enjoying just checking out all the different things you can do in these things, like sticking a tent on top of it and sleeping on top of your car.
Mm.
Yeah. So we'll see. Maybe I'll totally just get bored of this whole idea like a week from now and I'll be on to some other shit next week on the podcast. Stay subscribed.
So I have a quick question as somebody who hasn't been out in California for a bit and doesn't know the Bay Area super, super well, but my impression
is
that a lot of it's on fire. And so I'm curious, where are safe places to go camping where like a lightning strike might just not like utterly fuck you?
That's a good question. I do not have the answer to that. I know right now that my air filters, I opened the door earlier to bring in the groceries and the air filters on my house suddenly went red and started spinning up because we had to buy air filters because the smoke was so bad in our house.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that bad in the city as well, Drew?
It's pretty bad. The number is like 160 right now and below 50 is clean.
Over 150 is basically like
you
need
should not
to
be
not
outside.
Be outside.
Yeah.
Like
and
we're closing schools at 150.
Oh my god!
It smells like a barbecue
if they're not already closed because of the global.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, really. Just pile it on. What else you got?
Yeah, you're right. 150 smells like a barbecue. You're totally right. It smells like you're at a barbecue. Like not that your neighbor's having one. That you're actually at the barbecue.
Yes. Also joining us on the other side of the country, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Yeah, not too bad. Just, you know, worried that Danny's about to do something unwise in a fit of enthusiasm for the outdoors.
Maybe I won't be here next week.
I would do a little research, Danny.
You know, adventure's all about just doing. No, don't worry. I definitely will.
Nothing more American than being like, the great outdoors is my playground. No, I haven't done my homework. Goodbye.
I've seen Into the Wild. I forget how it ends. It's all fine,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So you're gonna get a bus, yeah, or exactly. Maybe next week you'll come back having purchased a Pontiac Aztec.
What's a Pontiac Aztec?
It's classic. It's Pontiac's Edsel, basically. SUV car that kind of marked the...
And it turns into a tent in the back.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh,
isn't
look at that.
Is that the car he drives in Breaking Bad?
Oh, wow. Yeah, we didn't have Pontiacs in Europe. That's amazing. I know I'm going to get a bunch of emails about it. Oh, I see the tent at the back. That's wild. And I'm going to get a bunch of emails about it as well, but they are bringing back the Bronco next year. They're bringing, and it looks crazy.
It's been long enough.
Yeah, people forgot about OJ now, so it's fine. They can reintroduce it. It looks completely crazy. You can get like modified doors with holes in them and stuff. It looks wild.
The thing you can't get, as I understand, though, is like there's no EV or like hybrid options for the Bronco. Like it's very much a, like it's this close to being like, I'd like to buy the Rolling Coal edition of the Bronco. Like it's that kind of rollout. But hey, people seem excited.
Yeah, the Wrangler doesn't either, which is, it's all, yeah. Considering as well how many people use these things with, like, solar panels on top when they go camping and, like, charge the hell out of them, it's almost a shame. Although I'm not sure how fast you can charge a car using panels. Who knows? Hey, shiftf1podcast@gmail.com.
There you go. If you are new to this Shift F1 podcast, welcome. And if you are new to Formula One, we have a podcast episode for you. We recommend listening to our preseason primer that assumes no prior F1 knowledge and gives the lowdown on how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you want to go back and listen to that, it is episode 96. Also, this show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons, covering racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, primers for other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. We recording this week, fellas?
We sure are. Rendezvous is going to be up for the weekend, so if you are interested in checking that out, it's a short movie, the shortest movie we'll probably ever cover after we did the longest movie ever last month. Yeah. If you want to have a very in-depth analysis of a very short piece of film, head on over to patreon.com/shiftf1. We are still perilously close to 1,000 patrons for our track day. Maybe I'll evolve it as well. Maybe instead of doing a track day, or while we wait for the track day, I'll do like a camping day in a fire somewhere.
Okay, yeah, emphasis on you.
Cannot wait until the latest fire outbreak is like located to Danny's like campground.
Oh no, what if
sometimes a man just wants s'mores and he cares not what it takes to produce them.
Speaking of American traditions, did anyone watch the Indy 500?
Yeah, I caught the highlights.
I watched the race.
How was it?
I mean, decent race, I think. A lot of scary crashes, a lot of fire.
Yeah, there
actually
was. Yeah, that brake fire was the craziest thing I've ever seen. One of the front rights, I don't know, did it lock or something? I've never seen a brake red with fire. Maybe that was in the other one. What's the thing called, carb day? Can someone explain carb day to me?
That
was,
I cannot.
Like the race. There was a race.
But that
the day
was definitely
before
in the race.
Oh, that
the
was
brake
in the
fire
race.
Was
okay.
In the race. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I'll tell you, I don't know whether I've just been spoiled by watching commercialless F1 or if things got worse while I've been gone, because, oh my God, I could not believe how many commercials NBC showed. Really? It was unbelievable. It was embarrassing.
Like how often
I thought,
like,
oh, you know, someone who's never seen motorsports before, the Indy 500. That I'm going to check that out. Or maybe, you know, maybe a listener was like, you know, I should check out this American version of motorsports' biggest race. And I can't imagine what people must have been thinking coming to that for the first time. Like, you can't follow anything because the stories just get interrupted. And then when they come back from a commercial break, they don't update you about what happened. Sometimes a pass for the lead will happen under commercial break, or you know, a crash, and maybe they'll replay it. But they do show side by side. You know, they put the race in like the size of a postage stamp on your screen while the ad plays much larger. It's horrendous. I don't even think there's a way. Please correct me, listeners, if I'm wrong about this. I hope I am, but I think even if you pay for like the NBC Sports Gold, I think you still get all the commercials.
Were the commentators like saying, "Oh, we'll be back after these messages," kind of thing, or was it just cutting them off? Or they were
so they've got so, like, two flavors of ad. They break away for a full commercial break, but then they will tell you, "Ah, we'll be back to see the end of the race nonstop or whatever." And you think, "Cool, we're gonna watch the race till the end." But no, that's when they start doing the insert ad in the big picture while the race unfolds. In
oh,
the little
you're
picture.
Kidding!
Oh, dude, it is terrible. Oh. I've had the same feeling. I think NBC's racing coverage feels like it's gotten worse on this front in the last year. But I also have started to feel like basketball too seems to have more ads than I remember. And maybe it is that during the hiatus, I just like completely forgot what it was like to watch shit with commercials. But it is so much harder now to maintain focus on a race and any sort of sense of like what is the state of play. God help us if Mothers, the greatest car polishing kit company on the planet Earth, God help us if they ever hit hard times and can't give us uninterrupted F1, because then we're screwed. But I do also think that it is self-defeating. I was seeing this thing where like NBA ratings have been in a long-term decline, and I do kind of wonder to what degree do sports that like really wedded the cable model, do they put themselves in a trap attracting like younger audiences and like having an appealing product? Because if you come from entertainment sources that don't run ads as a matter of course, and you're not like just conditioned to accept that like in an hour you will spend like 25 minutes watching ads.
Yeah.
It just sucks.
Yeah. Dude, I felt that way when I moved over here. It was just like, this is insane. When it would happen during like soccer games, because like obviously that's a sort of an apples to apples thing I can do, where like, no, we've got 45 minutes of uninterrupted like game and then we'll get to commercial break. I've been watching a lot of baseball just because I've missed sports so much, so I watched almost every A's game this year, and there's commercials during that, but you kind of don't care because the game has stopped, right? It's not interrupting it. I cannot imagine anything. I feel like NBA is bad or some of these ones are annoying, but racing in particular, when you're constantly waiting where anything can happen at any moment, must just feel like that's super annoying.
Yeah,
that's like the worst version of it.
And this is like it's an American institution. Like I am, you know, I'm not doing an IndyCar podcast. I'm doing a Formula One podcast. But like the Indy 500 is a big deal, and the fact that you just you know cripple it with this stuff. It's like it's not a watchable, fun experience, and like the commentary is bad. Like, I love me some Lee Diffie, and Townsend Bell usually has some good things to say, but like
PT's got to go.
Oh my God. Paul Tracy can get bent. And even the supporting cast of like Danica Patrick and Mike Tirico, they just have nothing insightful to say. I think because they're trying to like walk this fine line of like IndyCar fans might be watching the whole season, but then new people might be coming in. Oh, yeah. And so the average of that is just nothing, I guess. And so no one has anything insightful to say. No one can give you a sense of what the drivers are feeling or how strategy works or how an oval is different than a circuit. It's just nothing. So I think I was
I'll
off.
Say this. Like, I think you've definitely put your finger on it, that it is this notion that, like, we knew it need to appeal to, like, Joe casual viewer who just, like, stumbled across the Indy 500.
But they don't respect because anyone's intelligence.
Pardon?
They don't respect anyone's intelligence as a viewer.
No, that's I think this has always been the problem with the way, like, the U.S. broadcast sports is, like, they treat you like an idiot rather than just, like, assuming you will get it and get caught up in the excitement
you'll
of catch
up.
Play.
Yeah.
But like, if you watch the NBC Endurance Racing, which is broadly a lot of the same talent, the level of commentary and production is like way, way higher because they know ain't nobody watching endurance racing except like absolute nut jobs like myself who are like, awesome, okay, 2.5 hours left in this race. I know what I'm doing for the rest of the day. It's like that's who they're aiming at, and then suddenly becomes a really insightful broadcast. But like the Indy 500, that casting, like Mike Tirico is their general NBC sports guy. He's like their general anchor for their broadcasts. I think he's like he's actually an NFL expert, but he's just kind of there as the face of NBC Sports. So yeah, it's a mess, and it's kind of it's one of those things that it has watered itself down for like an audience of nobody. Is kind of how it feels.
Yeah. Cause like,
not like F1 and not like Shift F1. We'll never do that to you. So click on that Patreon button and subscribe and send us racing.
Yeah. All right. Today we will be discussing not the IndyCar race, but the Formula One one coming up in
ass.
You certainly could. Before we get to Spa, though, let's hit the news.
Do people know Rob is like 6'5"?
So there is that.
Yeah, 6'5".
Are you 6'5"? Wow. Yeah, you are. Yeah, yeah.
There is that video.
Just, you know
that
when people
did...
have like a. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, we did the video of the taste test, right, of the Blue Coast.
Yeah, although like, I'm standing on a lower step, so I look tiny.
Oh, are you, Drew? Oh, is that it, Drew?
Yes, I am. I'm standing on my knees.
And also the camera angle, yeah.
Yeah, it loses 2 inches.
No, but...
Yeah, it's just... Yeah.
Also,
that thing where you listen to podcasts for years and then you don't know what anyone looks like. Like, I've had that happen so many times where I've then seen someone in a video and I'm like, oh, I thought they were like, you know, a different ethnicity or something. You know what I mean? Like, you're just totally off. Because Rob's obviously from, you know, Antarctica as well.
Yeah,
that's where the accent comes from.
Yeah. But yeah, no. Paul, I'm also pretty sure I could beat Paul Tracy in a race because he was good at wrecking cars, not so much at racing him. But anyway.
Yes, the news. We mentioned it, I think, last time that McLaren had signed the new Concorde Agreement, as it is called. The governing document that also, dishes out or lays out how prize money is given out to teams, how teams are paid basically by the sport. Everyone has signed it now, which also means that everyone, all the teams, that is, have committed to Formula One through 2025, which is how long this current agreement lasts. So I thought I would... just go over what this agreement contains. The details are confidential, but we do know some stuff. So I didn't realize this before, but this is the first time that there has been any sort of financial regulation in the sport. The goal with this new document is to sort of bring the performance of the cars closer by reducing the financial disparity between the teams. So we're getting a budget cap, which, you know, hopefully will, you know, as we know, more money leads to faster cars on track generally. So this will tamp down on the gross spending of teams, you know, like Mercedes and Ferrari and Red Bull, and bring everybody a little closer together. So next year, as a result of this document. It will be a maximum budget cap of $145 million. And then it steps down by $5 million over the next 3 years to end at $135 in 2023. That cap, though, only covers expenditures that relate to car performance. So marketing costs are not included, race driver fees, and the cost of the team's top three personnel are not included in this, along with property costs and the purchasing of a customer engine supply deal, according to Formula1.com, which has been capped also at 15 million euros per season. So, you know, Mercedes selling engines can't, you know, price gouge their customers. So yeah, I think the mere existence of a budget cap offers the possibility for an F1 team also to actually make money, because 100% of their profits in the past could potentially be dumped back into the car for making it fast. So if you've got a cap on that, maybe your money can actually go to you know, other things instead of just your car performance. There are limits on aero testing, aerodynamic testing as well within this document. The default allowance, again, according to Formula1.com, for wind tunnel testing will be reduced by more than 30% of what it is now to just 40 runs in a wind tunnel per week. I think it's around 65 right now. And if you imagine the 40 runs per week number as 100% of your wind tunnel time, teams will actually receive or be reduced wind tunnel time by where they are in the championship. So in 2021, first place will get 90% of that. And this will be set at the beginning of the year based on last year's championship, and then reset on June 30th of every year. So first place will get 90% of that, and then 10th place will get 112.5% of that. And then the disparity grows in 2022. Yeah. So
Sorry. 10th being team, of course. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. 10th,
112. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. So what is it the year after that? Cause I kind of half remember what we said. Remember they did this stuff about 3 months ago. They brought in some of this wind tunnel stuff, but I think it's moved a little bit.
Yeah, so along with the cost cap, I think a lot of this stuff has been in sort of a voluntary adoption mode, so teams can like test it out, but they won't be penalized if they go over it until 2021. So in 2022, that wind tunnel time deficit gets increased. So when you're in first place, you get 70%. And then if you're in 10th place, you get 115.
So okay, yeah.
That'll, again, hopefully bring the disparity of the cars together. And prize money is probably the most secretive thing that is in this document. But Scott Mitchell over at therace.com, another URL with a hyphen in it, has some insights here that I'm just going to read. Gone are the inflated special payments for multiple teams. So if you're unfamiliar, the way this used to work is like Bernie Eccleston struck deals with like Mercedes, Red Bull, and we're like, you guys are important, so we're going to give you like a sweetheart deal here. Ferrari, I think, because of the fact that they have been in the sport since its inception, they get a special standalone bonus just for being Ferrari that is retained in this new Concorde agreement, but everybody else, sorry, see you later. Going back to Scott Mitchell, it is understood that a pot of prize money remains available to a specific group of teams with historical significance and success, however. So maybe depending on how those other teams do, they're more likely to get, I don't know. Title-winning teams and teams that finish in the top three in the driver or the Constructors' Championship in the past decade are also eligible for this pot. So over the past 10 years, if you finish in the top three, you get a piece of this as well. And that is derived from a percentage of F1's revenue. Reportedly 20% of what F1 makes over $650 million. So there's an incentive here for everyone to, you know, make the sport as good as it can be, because they get a bonus based on F1's revenue.
Yeah, they're sharing in the success of the sport.
Right.
Itself, yeah.
What is left over after the payments explained above will then make up the prize money pot. This is what used to be the column one and column two payments. So those were like static. Well, column one was static, like everyone gets a bonus. Column two are all the same bonus. And then column two was you get a bonus on a sliding scale depending on how you finish the championship. Now teams will get a share of one pot with a sliding scale of less than 1%, I assume, of F1's revenue based on championship finishing position, with the champion understood to be in line to receive 14% of the prize money and the last place team 6%. This is a lot of numbers out here, but it all boils down to like a much more simplified and equitable prize payout, which was interesting because leading up to this, Toto Wolff, I think, was the most vocal about he did not like what was in the Concord agreement, which was to me a good sign. And there were some hemming and hawing from other teams. But now that it's signed, I think everyone is like generally pretty happy, at least externally, with what's in it. So that's a good sign for me.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll get to it later, but it seemed like Haas were particularly happy about some of the payola stuff when it came to...
They were or were not?
Were, with the new sort of redrawing of that.
I mean,
hoping because money's been the big problem for them for sure.
Yeah, and the fact that they signed it and they said we'll be in here for the next 5 years is...
If there was a team out of that, you thought Williams might not, you know, we'll get to that as well, but Williams might not survive it and Haas might just peace out because they've sort of been on autopilot a bit. It kind of feels like autopilot, but on a downward trend for the past couple of years.
And then last thing here is the governance of the sport. So we no longer need a unanimous decision to make a rule change, which we did before. One team cannot block a new rule from coming into effect. Except
take that, Ferrari.
For Ferrari.
Uh-oh. You're kidding.
They still retain their veto.
Sounds like it's veto. Yeah, I don't know.
But whatever. They are, you know, they've got a gigantic fan base. They've been in the sport forever. I'm fine with a little bit of special treatment.
I'm not. I think it's molto male.
Their prize, you know, their bonus for just being Ferrari was sliced in half, I believe. So from like 100 million to 50, something like that.
Cool.
Yeah, so it seems like everybody's thumbs up on this. A lot of the weird Eccleston stuff got axed. So this, I think it seems to be paving the way for a more sustainable sport. You know, we will see over the next 5 years how this actually pans out, but I am optimistic, at least. Anything else in that Haas stuff?
No, there was some quotes from Gunter Steiner just about that the money was a big sticking point for them, and they're just hoping like to figure out the car and hopefully the new regulation. Same sort of notes that same beats he's been hitting for the past little while. What I am interested in is if the financial outlook changes, do we see the shakeup of drivers that we've been have been expecting, especially in regards to Grosjean, who seems like he's kind of coasting a bit.
Have to
wait and see.
We will. Williams was another team that signed that agreement.
Yeah.
You've got some news on that front, Danny, as well.
They're still around. This broke kind of late last week, I guess. It was kind of a bunch of people scrambling to talk about a good week to do it, I guess, in between the races. Williams are going to stick around, and they have done the thing that they have been trying not to do for this entire time, which is bring in an outside investor to help the whole thing stay afloat. They've bit the bullet, but hopefully they've found a good partner in, and I have to make sure I pronounce this right, Doralton. It's an investment group that nobody's heard of. So I'm going to hopefully dive into the details a little bit here. First of all, some sort of top-level stuff from race fans. Deputy Principal Claire Williams said that the team's sale was, quote, the end of an era for Williams as a family-owned team. It was founded by her father, Sir Frank Williams, in 1977. In a statement, the team said the sale received the unanimous support of the board of Williams, including Sir Frank, who determined the transaction delivers the best outcome for the company's shareholders and secures the long-term success of the Williams Formula One team. Williams' identity will be preserved through the takeover, as well as its historic name. The team will also remain on its current premises in Oxfordshire, UK, and retain the FW chassis naming convention, which of course refers to the founder, Sir Frank Williams himself. So yes, they have essentially sold the F1 side of the business, or they have taken a majority stake from Darlington, who I've done a little bit of research on. A lot of the scuttlebutt coming out of reporters right after this was saying that this isn't a particularly aggressive investment capital firm, if you can believe that. You know, I think anyone goes into the assuming anything about investment capital firms that they're there to make money, and you know, if something's not profitable, they'll tear it asunder and sell it off. But from their portfolio and from their what relatively little we know about it, and also mostly coming from what people have known the Williamses to be saying about how they feel about investment and what they're talking about here, they seem like a sort of a more hands-off company when it comes to this sort of stuff. Their portfolio includes a bunch of just random stuff. They have one company who's slightly involved in engineering that does some sort of work when it comes to oil platforms, which is why the quote from Claire in the statement, which was something along the lines of they have an interest in the sport, people who understand the sport. Apparently that comes from some folks who are on the board of Darlington, who are involved in cars in some respect in the UK. But they actually have never invested in any sporting organization team up until this point. They've got investments mostly in the US, predominantly in food, engineering, like I said, just a lot of like big corporations you've effectively never heard of.
And they are a US firm, right?
Yes, okay. They are. So... yeah, it's it seems like probably, you know, a bitter pill to swallow, I imagine, in some respects.
Over my dead body, Danny.
Yeah, I know, right. I think, I imagine, especially...
Is that in the Williams documentary or Netflix?
I can't remember, but yeah, it was that whole... The idea of, you know, Claire didn't want to be the person to have to sell, to be, you know, driving the train when they had to sell it. So it's happened. It sounds like perhaps Concorde was maybe a factor in, you know, having this happen when it did, how fast mm-hmm. it happened. It sounds like they are in talks for quite a long time around this. But the hope, at least, the optimism, and everyone about, I think everyone who's talking about this, F1 reporters and people involved in F1, they all want to be very optimistic about this. The optimistic angle on this right now is that they're not going to change much about Williams. Time will tell. But for the moment, at least, it secures Williams' short to medium term future in F1, which I feel like for as long as this podcast has been going, has been in doubt. So in that respect, congratulations to Williams.
I have two questions.
Go for it.
Number one, do you care that Williams is owned by somebody now?
I care for them. I think family-owned businesses are an artifice of a time that no longer exists. One that perhaps in motorsport particularly, in F1 in particular, I think, in a way that something I would feel nostalgic for, certainly, but I don't hold on to that world anymore. I was watching, I think this last week or so, I watched a bunch. Yeah, last week, because there was no race, I watched a bunch of old F1 TV stuff, and I was shocked at how many people are not involved in the sport or have passed away or have moved away. And F1 is such a different thing to what it was 5 or 10 years ago, that, and the world is, that I don't particularly, you know, mourn for it. I feel bad for Claire. I would have loved for them to be able to do it themselves. But if you had to ask me to choose between Williams being around and, you know, Claire Williams's ego, then always going to pick the first.
My second question, do you think Claire Williams is the team principal in 2022?
Yeah, all signs seem to suggest that that would that is going to be the case. From what I have heard from a lot of the reporting around this, while the sort of deal has been struck, again, I think maybe sped up a little bit because of Concord, some of the structural elements of the company and personnel stuff is probably going to be solidified more over the next 6 to 12 months. But from what it sounds like, they don't want to do a shakeup. I would imagine, I mean, I'm no investment capitalist or whatever, but like, I would imagine that given the current sort of like, uncertain times, that the last thing they want to do is pull somebody in. Her future in the sport over the next couple of years, we've talked a lot, you know, yourself, Rob, and myself have talked a lot about what is the problem with Williams. Is it the car? Is it the people? Is it just this? Is it the way that the whole thing has been structured and the way it's run? Like, it seemed like maybe that was part of it in the documentary. So, I don't know. I think in the short term, I think she's here next year for sure. I think they'll keep her in the company. I think the big alarm bell that would go off now more than ever would be if Claire went, because it is a family business. Maybe she'll shift roles though. Maybe she won't be team principal in a couple of years and will step into a different role. I imagine she'd probably half enjoy that as well. But what's cool about this, I think, is that it actually sort of creates the opportunity for a new arc in their story and perhaps one of redemption for, you know, the team and for her.
I'm just going to say, Drew, after seeing that documentary about the Williams family and their path in F1, I think one of the weird subtexts of it is that, not even subtext, it is the film. One, has this entire endeavor been good for the Williams family overall, right?
Right.
Like, are they a happier family because they all followed Sir Frank down this particular rabbit hole of being an F1 team? And two,
Jonathan, is that the brother?
The one who's been like abandoned on the island of misfit F1 parts?
Yeah,
I think so. But the other part of this is the Williams team was at its most successful when basically nobody named Williams was running it day to day, right? Like, this is one of those weird things of the team sucked when Frank was running it. When Frank could no longer run it, and Patrick Head, I believe, took over, the team started to have some enormous success. And then as the Williams family stepped back into the breach and took on more of a leading role, the team began to decline quite a bit. And so I think there's a lot of strange sentimentality around this idea of Williams as a family business, when arguably the thing that's probably held that team back the most is, to an extent, that it's been sort of linked to the fortunes of a truly odd collection of individuals. But this deal is also kind of a strange one. You don't hear about... So I guess Doralton is a family office, meaning that it is... family offices can't manage other people's money, right? So... that's the deal. If a family office might have portfolios on, like, not on par, but like in some ways comparable to like decently sized mutual funds and such. But the thing that a family office can't do is take other people's money and manage it for them and like charge fees. This is somebody's this is some ultra rich family's vehicle for investing.
Right.
And I am really curious what is the play here. Because with a publicly traded company, with a publicly held in investor group, you do kind of expect you have to know what the play is. You have to see like what are the ways that what's the path to profitability.
Yeah, you gotta have a 5-10 year plan, right?
Yeah. A company like Darlton doesn't necessarily have to have that. And so it's kind of just it's a weird deal.
It is. I went through all the companies they'd invested in prior, and it's all stuff from 10, 15 years ago. Like it's not like they're bursting with all these new blue chip kind of companies or anything.
Your point, I think, is a good one, though, is that like Williams, they're like George Lucas when he decided to direct Star Wars. Like, as soon as you put,
right.
You know, the one in charge that whose thing it is, maybe it doesn't turn out so great.
Yeah, I think that is kind of it. Like it's undeniably Sir Frank's passion for racing that created the F1 team, but in terms of all their success, it was largely the competence of other people that delivered it. And so I think anything that kind of frees the team to be a little more advanced, a little less driven by this obsession over identity and doing everything yourself as a independent operator, that's probably all to the good. But I am so curious and maybe a little skeptical about what the Williams operation looks like in a few years' time.
Mm. Yeah. A couple of quick hits here. That engine mode ban we mentioned, instead of being instituted before Spa, will instead be pushed back to Monza. So we'll probably cover that next time. And speaking of the calendar, Rob, what's going on here?
Well, so Turkey is a done deal. Turkey is happening, but it also sounds like the 2020 F1 calendar might be signed, sealed, and delivered. That we have our final run of races. So that's a little bit confusing, however, because I think F1 has also left the door open to more events being added still. But it does seem like at this point it's pretty much locked in for a 17 race season. So to run through that really quickly, that means that obviously next we have Spa, then we're going to Monza, then to Mugello in Italy. Then sadly we must go to Sochi. Then 11 October for the Eiffel Grand Prix. If we had
65.
Any good, why isn't that the German GP? Is it just because that's too fraught now? Like because they killed the German GP, they can't just bring it back for this one event, but they're racing.
I think they're just huge Eiffel 65 fans, so they're going to play that blue dabba dee dabba da song for the entire length.
Perfect.
Of the, yeah.
Perfect. Then 25 October, going to Portugal. Then we've got the return to Imola, and what was just added, the 15th November, Turkish Grand Prix at Hooray. Istanbul.
Awesome.
And then we're going to a doubleheader at Bahrain, and then wrapping the season in mid-December at Abu Dhabi.
I'm gonna miss Interlagos.
Yeah,
always fun to have it at the end. Yeah,
it's a great circuit. Improbable.
Double Bahrain might not be bad.
I think that'll be good.
That's a fun track. Yeah, that's one of the Tilkadromes that people just always kind of vibe with. It's gonna be so strange having it at the end of the season. It's usually the second race, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it'll be good though to I associate that with some decent races, though maybe that is still the halo of that like vicious fight that Rosberg and Hamilton got into at Bahrain like that one year, or Leclerc's star-crossed run at the circuit last year.
What's the date on Abu Dhabi and Bahrain?
Abu Dhabi is the 13th of December to wrap up the season, and then they're racing at Bahrain 29th November and 6th of December.
They could feasibly do a day race then in Bahrain if it's that late in the year. It won't be because the heat in the summer in that part of the world is obviously insane, and the humidity. But they did Bahrain used to be a day race, and then they made it a night race. Am I going crazy?
Bahrain.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
It was a day race, and it wasn't good.
No.
I think partly because it just didn't photograph well.
Very flat and sort of,
Yeah, once they started shooting it at night, it really became one of the more spectacular circuits with the lit dunes. So that's pretty cool. But the other crucial thing is that F1, with a 17-race season, has met its obligations for the broadcast TV deal. Which is where the real money for F1 has always been. And so this is like they've basically pulled it off, right? Like I think when we were talking back when COVID first hit, one of the things that was potentially so apocalyptic about this season was that they wouldn't be able to have a championship that like met the criteria for satisfying their TV obligations. Mm. And the minute you're in the world of prorating that, that would have just been a really hard blow, especially to those teams toward the bottom end of the scale. Now they've done it. And so this has pretty effectively salvaged the season.
Yeah, cool. Good on them. Yeah, it's wild. All those months ago when I said we'd have like maximum five races. I'm glad I was wrong.
Well, speaking of pretty circuits, let's take it to Spa, Danny.
Yeah, Spa. As you said at the top of the show, in the valley in the beautiful Ardennes forest in Belgium, side of the Battle of the Bulge, and many a fantastic music festival. It's the longest track on the circuit. It's 7 kilometers. It also holds the crazy high average speed of about 227 kph. It's clockwise 19 turns, but there's plenty of left-handers in there as well. It's also one of the most unpredictable in terms of weather, not just the sort of general what's it going to be like today? Is it going to rain? Is it going to be hot? But also all over the track, the amount of ground that this track covers and the topography of the where it finds itself means that there often is relief rain coming off of some of the valley hills. It's just long enough that sometimes it's raining in one part of the circuit and not yet in another. So you get absolutely loads of variability here. The drivers love it. The corners are fun. There's a lot of sort of like double apex corners, a lot of fast uphill straights, a lot of fast downhill curves. It's historically quite dangerous as well. It was one that in which there was, you know, lots of changes have been made to it. It used to be incredibly, incredibly long. But of course, in recent years, it's also been incredibly dangerous and tragically so. Last year, with the passing of Antoine Hubert during the Formula 2 race there. By the way, actually, have you played much of the F1 game?
No, not this year's.
Because you go through the F2 races, and I had totally forgotten, but Antoine Hubert is in it. Because it's last year's F2 season, and I guess they talked to the family about it as well. I was doing a season in F2 in Spa and overtook Antoine Hubert, and it was the most like it just felt cold. It was just like, it was like kind of nice, but also like I stayed well clear of him. Like, you know what I mean? It was kind of like that really sucks. But it's nice that he's in there, I think. Obviously, the family were totally fine with it, which is nice. So, you know, last year, obviously, we had a terrible crash on what is also sort of the top of what is also one of the most famous, if not the most famous, turn in F1, Eau Rouge or Radillon. It's a sort of a triple apex little system there at the top of the hill. There are two DRS straights on this, the Kemmel straight, which is right after Eau Rouge. It's pretty much the only flat straight part of this entire track. And then you have another one after what is known as Blanchiment, which is the 17th turn on this track before you get down to the chicane at the bottom, which is taken incredibly fast. Most of the track is taken incredibly fast. Even Pouhon, which is this turn 12, which is the one that always kills everyone on the racing game, right? It's just impossible to do.
That's so downhill. Hard.
Yeah, the downhill left-hander.
Off camber as well?
Yeah, it's wild. And it's, you take that in seventh gear. I watched an interview with Verstappen recently where he said it's one of his favorite corners in the F1 track. So obviously they like it quite a lot. It's usually with these track walks to try and give you a couple of spots to keep your eye out for it. Honestly, this is one of those tracks that just every single corner has its own little fun thing going on. So much variability. The tight hairpin on turn one is you know, we're used to tight first turns, but this one is you've got so little downforce because of how it's like slightly downhill, and the exit of it is so important, so critical, because you basically are going almost flat out until you hit Lacombe on turn 7. That probably the two big spots for drivers are the entrance into Blanchiment, kind of like that tight right hander turn 16, which is again taken flat out. because both of those sections, you've got a massive straight and you're basically just trying to get as fast as you can so you can use the DRS to try and make the overtake. But it's not one of those tracks where you just get to overtake there. Spa is a track where you can overtake almost anywhere if you've got the grip and if you're gutsy enough. So hopefully it'll be a fun race. It's rarely a boring race at Spa. It's usually interesting. We often get safety cars. If nothing else, you know, we'll get a bit of weather, might be nice, but I'm not sure what's going to happen this weekend. Maybe Drew knows.
Well, Danny, according to Google Weather here, actually, I think this is weather.com data they're pulling in from. It's going to be a chilly one. High 50s Fahrenheit, or around 15 degrees Celsius. A little windy at, about 19 kilometers an hour, or what is that, 12 miles an hour. Slightly lower on race day. The previous was for qualifying. But the big question, precipitation.
Mm.
I'm happy to announce qualifying 62%, ooh. Race day 80.
What? Yeah, there we go.
Oh, yeah. My God. Oh, my God. That's great. This is, as well, this is the week they usually do it. So I know a lot of the races got moved around and it's all crazy party, but this, it's the last week, first week of September, last week of August is usually when Spa happens. So
The week from Tuesday to Tuesday that on my view here, only one day, Thursday, sees any sun. The rest of it is just rain.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So going into this race, let's go down the driver standings here, shall we? Lewis Hamilton on top with 132 points. Max Verstappen in second place with 95. Valtteri Bottas behind him with 89. Then we've got Charles Leclerc in fourth place with 45. Lance Stroll and Alexander Albon are tied for fifth place with 40 points. Lando Norris right behind in seventh place with 39 points. Sergio Perez is in eighth with 32. And then we've got Carlos Sainz with 23 and Daniel Ricciardo rounding up the top 10 with 20 points. Then we've got a tie between Sebastian Vettel and Esteban Ocon in 11th place with 16 points. Pierre Gasly's in 13th with 14 points. Nico Hülkenberg hanging in there with 6 points. Antonio Giovinazzi and Danny Kvyat have 2. They're in 15th place. Magnussen's in 17th. And then Kimi Raikkonen, Nicholas Latifi, George Russell, and Romain Grosjean are all pointless. Constructor standings. Mercedes on top with 221 points. Red Bull's in second with 135. Then Racing Point with 63. McLaren with 62. And Ferrari with 61.
Wow.
Renault's in sixth place with 36 points. Alfa Tauri has 16. Alfa Romeo has 2. Gene Haas and team have 1 point. And Williams bringing up the goose egg. If you'd like to join our fantasy league, you can do so by using the link in the show notes. But you can also email us, Danny, at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/emails.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have some emails this week. We get emails every week. Thank you to everyone who sends emails. I do read all of them, even if we don't read them out. This one, I'm not going to read out, but shout out to Michael Patterson, who is a data scientist. He likes science so much that he wrote a 1,500-word email about AWS, which I really appreciate, but it was quite in the weeds and long, so we're not going to read it out. But thank you very much, Michael.
Is there an upshot to that one? It.
The upshot is, there was no broad sort of outcome from it even, so it's hard to, like, even summarize it. But basically he was saying was that Rob was totally on point last week and that the way in which they are, like, analyzing and presenting data science is almost entirely removed from reality in a way that Michael was saying is very infuriating to him and his job, because people come to him with data and expect it to plug it into the magical data machine and then it spits out like the reality of this stuff and the way in which data should be used. Like, he was saying you could use it for like timing in this way and that way, but like arbitrary stuff like who's the fastest F1 driver, like he's like that data doesn't work that way, right? Like, and without presenting how the data was used, then you don't get any you need to kind of know why, how it was being analyzed in a way to show it. And he also said, which is something I think both of you have said, that the obfuscation of that data, that like somebody is like 75% of speed on this corner, is one of the biggest no-nos, that like that's not presenting information in a way that's usable to people. So yeah, he seemed to basically agree, and then wrote a manuscript about it. So thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
This first email I'm going to take from Martin Lunsford says, it's all about the F1 2020 game, which we talked a little bit about. I've been having a blast with it last week. I have my race wheel in my my basement downstairs, and I've been jumping in there because it's too hot in the rest of the house. Martin says, so I started my career in F1 at Haas, since I'm the only American on the grid. Once I won the Drivers' Championship, I moved to Red Bull. This then had a strange effect. Max moved to McLaren, while Norris and Ocon went to AlphaTauri. Grosjean retired, and Kimi went to Haas, and Giovinazzi went to Renault. Why the hell would the algorithm make Max move instead of Albon? This made me laugh so much when I read it. Can we just parse this? Let's just try and figure out a world in which any of these makes sense. So the domino. So
Martin... Haas driver's champion.
Yeah.
Decides he's going to Red Bull.
Well, now Red Bull can't accommodate two big dogs. Like, Martin is the shit. Like, suddenly Max is Daniel Ricciardo. And he's looking at Martin, the new golden child of Red Bull. And it's like, I don't want any part of that. Because now, like, that guy's an American F1 star. Like... No, suddenly I'm irrelevant. Oh, Dutch fans, the orange cloud, the orange wall. Who gives a shit? We got an American.
He goes to the orange team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good point. That's it. Brandalism.
Yeah. So Albin stands pat because it makes sense for him. But Max needs to go to a place where he can be the
lead
driver.
And he goes and joins Ricardo at McLaren, his old team.
His old buddy. Old pal.
Man, poor Ricardo.
Norris, and right. I guess in this world, Ocon is still at McLaren. So we have Norris and Ocon, right? So, because what season are we? Because this is this
no,
season.
No, so Ocon leaves Renault to open up the spot for Giovinazzi.
Mm-hmm.
Ocon goes to Renault,
AlphaTauri.
AlphaTauri.
Norris and Ocon are together at AlphaTauri.
At last.
Yeah. At last, yeah. Always wanted to be part
Grosjean
of that.
Grosjean retiring and Kimi staying in to go to Haas, that makes all the sense in the world to me.
That is 100% doable. Could you imagine how happy Magnussen would be if Kimi was his... That'd be great.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? He'd be the most chill. Grosjean's the type of guy who asks teacher a million questions, you know, at the team meetings, and Kimi just sits there and just doesn't give a shit.
Hold on, though. I actually see now. I feel cheated. We don't live in this reality because Kimi and Gunther, I think, would be one of the most fascinating oil and water like combinations that you would ever see. Because Kimi just wouldn't take it. He just wouldn't take it. And so I could see that being pretty fantastic.
But you know what? I think it's a match made in heaven. Because you know, Kimi also wouldn't make mistakes.
That's also
Iceman.
True.
He doesn't tend to do it. Remember that one time he collided with Bottas on the penultimate lap? Was the one time Kimi's made a mistake. We still talk about it. Kimi's as cool, cold as ice. Giovinazzi at Renault.
He's no Martin Lunsford, but yeah. All right, our next email comes from Faiz Imam. It regards hydrogen cars. Hey, Rob was asking what the deal was with hydrogen cars, and I'd let you know it's something I've researched quite a bit in my studies in sustainable mobility. Hydrogen is a totally legitimate and useful technology, but it has two key issues that prevented it from getting mass adoption. The first is the first problem is one that it shares with EVs, which is that the fuel cell and storage system is both very expensive and very heavy. Like EVs, this is being developed, and it's better than it used to be, but still an obstacle. The second and more serious issue is refueling, and the wider issue of a national hydrogen infrastructure. It's not just something that you can get everywhere as opposed to electricity. This is why EVs have exploded in the last few years while hydrogen cars have disappeared. I do not expect any of us will ever see a hydrogen-powered vehicle in day-to-day life. However, they can still absolutely have a role. You can set a lot of power and have high capacity even if you do not care about the weight of large tanks. The main use they're expected to serve in a clean future is in heavy industry and short-range trucking, where they can be expected to have a central refueling depot to return to, and where they don't have to worry about being extremely heavy. The very fast refueling, as opposed to batteries, allows them an excellent role in mining, for example. P.S. All of the above depends on how the hydrogen is sourced. Currently, most of the world's supply comes as a byproduct of oil drilling. But clean hydrogen from renewable electricity is the goal of a lot of current research. Love the show, guys. Keep it up. So that's interesting to me. So I'm wondering, short-range trucking, like last-mile delivery, is that the idea there where it's like...
Or is he talking about extraction, you know?
Yeah, well, he's definitely talking about extraction, like the huge those huge dump trucks maybe that you see at like mining sites.
Yeah, go out and get the tiberium, bring it back to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
But... I'm very like, but the short range trucking, I do kind of wonder if that's last mile where it's like suddenly the model would be like what, panel trucks,
right? Well, that's interesting because I remember when the electric trucks started coming in vogue when I lived in London, the first electric cars that we saw were what you're talking about, that last mile delivery, like UPS kind of stuff, right? Like those types of things that. And I guess that was also a byproduct of that same issue of just, well, that was, I guess, the battery problem where they just weren't able to run that long. I could totally see that. I wonder if we're going to see more, you know, with COVID and with the sort of patterns that we've developed globally. I wonder if we're going to be doing a lot more, you know, I never did Instacart before, you know what I mean? Like I liked going to the grocery store. Like, I wonder if there is just more, like Amazon seems to, obviously Jeff Bezos has made a fortune doing this because everyone's ordering off Amazon. Like, I wonder, have we settled into a world in which we do order more? And even if the world was to, you know, if we clicked our fingers and a vaccine was immediately in everyone's bloodstream tomorrow, would we still order as much as we do now?
I try not to do this too much, but I am going to plug my website here.
Go for it.
So Motherboard over at Vice actually does have some of the best reporting on gig economy stories and also around logistics.
Oh, cool.
So kind of leading the reporting on gig labor is a reporter by the name of Lauren Cowrie-Gurley. And leading the report on like infrastructure and particularly the postal service these days, we've got Aaron Gordon. And if there's a through line to a lot of the reporting they've done around this, as with a lot of these things, these conveniences we're talking about do rely a lot on certain distortions of the market that exist right now, like. The reason having your groceries delivered is viable right now is because there's a huge pool of cheap labor that Instacart can like algorithmically kind of exploit, right? Like,
right.
I think just today we published a story about how the Instacart app, a bit like Uber, keeps getting more punitive to shoppers because now you're being like, it's becoming much more like of a taskmaster. Your responsiveness is measured. So Instacart in particular, just as a broad statement, I would say probably not the food delivery service I would use.
Oh, really? Okay, their practices might be
among the worst, but none of them are great because they all share these problems, which is that you have companies providing a service, but they don't have a workforce. They don't have the workforce they're obligated to serve in any respect.
Right. And we've seen that in California recently with the Uber and Lyft stuff where they're trying to force them to have them as employees, right, and give them healthcare and stuff like that.
Right. And so if these loopholes are ever closed, like the entire business model falls apart because the entire thing basically exists on sidestepping a lot of labor law.
Like the profit margin is based on this disruption. It doesn't work at all if you have to play by the same rules as everyone else.
Right. And the entire contractor model kind of depends on people independent contractors are meant to be like independent contractors, right? I run a small firm. It was never intended to be, I'm a cab driver, but I don't have a medallion.
Right.
Ditto the entire logistics thing, like us being able to have things delivered right and left. One of the things that we're seeing a lot is that the backbone of delivery has been, in a lot of cases, the Postal Service. Hmm. Not just even when orders are supposedly being fulfilled by like UPS or FedEx or any of those numerous private parcel companies that Amazon funds and creates for itself. UPS is still doing a lot of the heavy lifting. The Postal Service is still doing a lot of the heavy lifting for that. And what happens if the Postal Service begins to break down or go away in a move toward privatizing it?
Hmm.
A lot of the convenience factors we're talking about would probably start to dry up. We would see degradations in service. That goes triply if you are not like in a major metro area. So I think there's a weird thing with the new normal and the way our patterns have shifted, which is that all of it is kind of taking place in this weird context of not only does the gig model rely on a large pool of available and exploitable labor, but in particular, COVID itself created a lot of people that you would never see doing jobs like this. We have a couple shoppers that we work with regularly that, like, this is not their main gig. And so they're incredible. They're incredibly detail oriented people because their real jobs are on hiatus right now.
Right.
And so if things go back to normal ish in 6 months, will convenience still be there? I kind of have my doubts.
It's wild. Do you want to plug the service you do use, Rob?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the service I use is an odd one. It's called Dumpling.
And you can only buy dumplings. Got it. I'm on it. I love it. Yeah. Sounds great.
So basically have
dim sum all day, baby.
No, so I use a service called Dumpling. And that's a bit of an interesting one because it's not really a platform in the way Instacart is. You're not working through Instacart. It's more like, and this is the model of every single shopper I work with right now. It's as if people have started their own shopping business and they just post their rates on like the job board in the area they serve.
You
can just click through and be like, this person seems to, they show what stores they go to. They show what like their specialties are. So
if the someone is like,
yeah. And right. That's very much the point. Dumpling doesn't charge like huge fees for the platform. So more of the money ends up in the shopper's pockets. So the weird trade-off with that, though, is that you aren't dealing through the platform. Once you contract with somebody on Dumpling, you're just exchanging phone numbers and like you're coordinating these messages. But the result of that for me has been we now have like three or four people who we know and who know us that we work with basically directly.
Right.
Don't pick that milk. Instacart.
Don't pick that milk. That's the wrong milk. And you don't like that milk.
That's exactly, dude, it's a dumb thing, but it totally is a real thing where someone's like, you guys, I saw they had extra Rainier cherries at the store this week. You guys really like those, right? So I got an extra bag and I'm like, hell yes, you're the best. So that's the good shit.
Nice. I'm going to get on that. Drew, you got the last email.
Yeah. Jed writes in, for the races that aren't in the F1 games, could you do the video track walk in Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020 instead? Drew is a licensed pilot after all. Thanks and love the show.
How many tracks have you been to?
So far, I think I've only flown over Sonoma.
Oh, cool. Nice. Yeah. As it happens, I did fly over Coda yesterday.
Nice.
Yeah, because I was doing Austin. I was doing a trip over Austin.
I wonder if you could land on the...
I've seen surface. People land on Silverstone.
Oh, yeah. You can land.
You can land. So,
fucking yes.
But you know the way it kind of guesses stuff?
Yeah.
It did something weird. It doesn't have... The thing, because if you've flown into Austin, you can see Coda it's impossible to miss almost because it's right beside the airport. It's on the flight path in the east. And also it has, of course, that big thing that you can stand on right in the middle of it, right? Yeah, so that's not in it. But it also didn't put a skyscraper there because, for instance, I did a flight right after that. I did National Reagan Airport in D.C., which all the Democrats there call National. I flew from there to Kent, which is over in Annapolis, where I used to live, and I flew over the Washington Monument, and it's just a skyscraper. It's got
is
like
it
a lot.
Really? Yeah.
Well, did you guys see why the Melbourne obelisk existed?
No, I never knew why. Yes. I never heard out why. Why is it?
So, Open Streets collates data on, like, there's an address. We know a building is there, but someone can submit, like, facts about the building, including its height.
Okay.
Somebody like fat fingered the number of stories the building at this address in Melbourne is. I think it's supposed to be a 22 story building. Someone put 212 in for in for the size of the building, and so the game is pulling where Open Streets data exists. It is pulling that data into the simulation, and so it was just like, okay, I know this building is at this address, and it's 212 stories tall.
That's amazing.
Got it. And builds just that ridiculous monolith. It's incredible.
It's so good. It's one of those things. It's like the Uncanny Valley or something where everything in that world looks so unbelievably real. Sorry, if you don't know, by the way, Microsoft Flight Simulator basically creates it's the entire map of the entire globe based off of Bing Maps and a bunch of other data that they've pulled. And it creates a version of the world that's like incredible to fly over. But every once in a while, like Ocean Beach, for instance, Drew, there's a bunch of buildings south of the Cliff House for some reason. And it's like they just stand, you're like, why are they there? Or the sand dunes that are down there are like way higher because they must look higher or something. So
you compare it to like what we were working with before, and this is light years
right, because you've been using flight sims for years. I flew over my hometown and like it made me sad, it made me happy as well, because I miss home. I'm not gonna fly home for a long time, but it really, really felt like it. Like even the cloud coverage, I did real time, and it was like, yep, that's what it's like being in Ireland. You get fucking 17 layers of different clouds and they're flying. Like it gave me like that same sense of when I go on when I take a bus in Ireland and I'm going through the countryside. It was remarkable. But yeah, it's basically my mission in that game to visit every F1 track. What's it? Spa's probably gonna be the hardest to land on, right?
It's gonna be tricky to find too in the
Yeah.
No, because Spielberg, Spielberg is a clear hilltop, though. Like, yeah, you probably don't have the runway, but like.
That's what I'm worried about.
Spa's trees.
Yeah, you got to be on the ball there.
And this game puts trees where there shouldn't be trees sometimes. It's heavy
that.
On the trees, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess Monaco is probably the hardest now to think about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that might be tough. I was going to say, like, it would probably be easier with a helicopter, which this game does not currently have. But Red Bull did do a race, I think, between somebody in an F1 car. Was it Coulthard, maybe? Or maybe it was Verstappen.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah.
A race between an F1 car and a plane. And I think it was an extra, which is definitely in Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Oh, really?
So we could try to replicate that, yeah.
That's wild.
That's a fun idea.
Fly around the world.
Well, if you'd like to send us a tweet as well, you could do that at ShiftF1 Podcast on Twitter. I am at Drew Scanlon. That is at Danny O'Dwyer. And at Rob Zachney. That is us around the internet. Should we take it around the world, Danny?
It's around the world. Yeah.
Formula 2 and Formula 3 are supporting Formula 1 at Spa this weekend. We have another IndyCar race at Gateway Motorsports Park on Saturday and Sunday, looks
sponsored
like.
Sponsored by Hewlett-Packard, is it?
It's the Bomarito Automotive Group?
Bomarito, got it.
It's a really bad burrito. Supercars are at a place which is one of my favorite names of a place on earth, Townsville.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, that's very generic. I love it. Yeah.
World Superbike is at Motorland Aragon in Middle Earth. The World Rally Cross Championship is at Kuvola circuit in Finland. Super Formula is at Twin Ring Motegi, which is in the Tochigi prefecture.
What a prefecture. Shout out to our boy Takuma Sato, by the way. We did. I don't think we said it. Who won the Indy 500.
All right. Well, now I got to put spoiler notes in the show notes. Thanks, Danny.
Every time that dude wins a major race, which I guess is just Indy, every time that happens, though, it just messes me up because, like, how did that guy turn into a great race car driver?
Right.
And I'm still not convinced he did. Like, if you watch IndyCar, Takuma still does Takuma shit that you remember from his time in F1. Like, he remains not necessarily the most consistent or, like, judicious driver you've ever seen. But, like, man, that guy's got a feel for Indy.
The missing piece of the pie was David Letterman, clearly.
Yeah.
Feel free to delete this from the podcast or if you need to. I'm sorry.
I'll just put spoiler tags somewhere in the show notes. Let's see. We have the NASCAR Xfinity Series is at Daytona Beach, Florida for the Wawa 250 powered by Coca-Cola.
Now I miss Maryland again.
Wait, God. That means something to you?
Wawa, yeah. That's the gas. Wait, Drew, do you know what Wawa is?
No.
Oh no, it's the
better be like a Crab Shack or something.
No, it's like the gas station. It's like the you go to the Wawa's, it's a gas station, but it has, like, you know, your food court, it's got all your stuff.
Ooh.
Have you ever heard of Sheetz?
Like Sheetz.
Yeah. So Sheetz, yeah. Sheetz is like is PA. So they're all mad about Sheetz if you cross over into Pennsylvania. If you're on this side of the Potomac, it's all about Wawa. So, Wawa's pretty good. I miss Wawa. It's good stuff. I miss getting my big gulp.
Big gulps, huh? we've got Gander Mountain Trucks at Madison, Illinois at the Worldwide Technology Raceway at Gateway. Is that what we're calling it now?
Tell you, man, Hewlett-Packard. Coming back
for the Car Shield 200. That'd be a much longer race. Presented by CK
it's like that,
Power.
It's like that skyscraper in Adelaide. Yeah. Now, or we have to keep going.
That's right. I put too many zeros.
And we got NASCAR.
Oh my!
Also at Daytona Beach at the International Speedway there for the Coke Zero Sugar 400.
Zero sugar, zero taste.
My darling Dry Dean was last weekend, so
that's it. Formula One kicking off this Friday, August 28th at 5 a.m. Eastern Time is free practice one on ESPN, followed by free practice two at 8 a.m. on ESPN2. The Deuce.
Ooh.
Saturday, August 29th, free practice 3 is on ESPN2 as well at 6 a.m., followed by qualifying at 9 a.m. on ESPN, the regular. And then the race, everyone, Sunday, August 30th at 9:05 a.m. Eastern Time on ESPN.
It's raining.
Final thoughts, Danny?
Hallelujah, yeah. I hope it rains. Even if it doesn't, it'll be a great race, let's be honest. But let's,
Spa's often good.
Yeah, let's get the Bernie squirters out there.
And never say that phrase again.
Are we seriously not doing phrasing anymore? Yeah.
No, I finally found my vanity plate. Bernie squirters. There we go. Thanks. Thanks, guys.
Rob, any final thoughts? Okay.
Nope, not anymore. It just left my head.
If you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes, you can do so at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.
Yeah.